Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
Toto, I've a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. That's right, Dorothy. This is Movie Addict Headquarters. You don't have to be a movie addict to visit here, but if you are one, it's definitely the place for you. I'm your host, Betty Jo Tucker, and today my excellent producer, Nikki Starr, and I will be talking with filmmaker David Wirth about his upcoming book, The Citizen Kane Crash Course on Cinematography, a wildly fictional account of how Orson Welles learned everything about the art of cinematography in half an hour, or was it a weekend? Wow, I know that's a long title, but believe me, this is one of the most fantastic, fascinating books about filmmaking I've ever read. So, Nikki, are you ready to learn something exciting about cinematography?
I can't wait.
Neither can I. And so I'll bring David in just a few minutes. But first, I'd like listeners to know how eminently qualified he is to write a book about filmmaking. He's worked on more than 30 feature films as both a director and a director of photography. He was the director of photography on two features for Clint Eastwood, Bronco Billy, which is my all-time favorite Clint Eastwood film, and Any Which Way You Can, which I also enjoyed very much. He served as the director of photography on Bloodsport and the director of Kickboxer, and he also helmed and did the cinematography for the thrillers Time Lapse, starring Roy Scheider, and The People's Game with Dennis Hopper. In addition, and I don't know where he finds time for this, but he has taught at UCLA, directed TV episodes, and teaches part-time at the Dodge College of Film and Media Arts and the School of Cinematic Arts at USC. Well, of course, it's a great pleasure to have him on our show today. Welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters, David.
My pleasure entirely, Betty Jo. Thank you for having me.
We're just so honored to have you here today, and congratulations on your wonderful book. You know, I'm very excited to hear you talk about it, but first, why don't you tell us why you decided to become a cinematographer, and what's the most satisfying thing about it to you?
Well, back in the day when I was starting to get into cinematography, I saw a lot of guys that I called Gucci bag directors. These were guys who raised $100,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 somewhere selling insurance, splashed some tanning lotion on their face, picked up a Gucci bag, and said, "I'm a film director." And I wanted to have more substance to I always wanted to direct, and I became a cinematographer primarily to become a better director.
I see.
And so I spent a long apprenticeship working as a director of photography and an editor so that there was no chance that I would be a Gucci bag director. I would be someone who knew lenses and who knew new cameras and who knew film emulsions and knew how to cover a scene and shoot a scene and edit a scene and put a scene together.
And you certainly have succeeded in doing that. Do you have a favorite among the films that you've done?
I have several, and, you know, they're all, it's like children, you know, some are brighter than others, but they're all your children, so you love them all. But as far as a director of photography, the film I did with Clint, the first feature, Bronco Billy, is one of my all-time favorites, because that was my first really big studio, big star, big union movie. And then also the feature I did in Hong Kong and Macau called China Cry is another favorite. And as far as directing, it's the Dennis Hopper film, and you mispronounced it a little bit. It's actually called The Prophet's Game, not The People's
Game.
Oh,
The Prophet's Game. Thanks for calling
that
to my
mind. Yeah, it's not a problem. It's a thriller that I did with Dennis Hopper, and it was just a thrill. Well, first of all, after having worked with Clint Eastwood, you think, well, you're never going to work with another icon like Clint Eastwood.
Oh,
and,
I can understand why you'd feel that way, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Dennis is actually an icon who goes back further in the industry than Clint, because he goes all the way back to Rebel Without a Cause and Giant with the icon of icons, Mr. James Dean.
Right.
So I was in cowboy heaven to be able to work with Dennis, and he was an absolute sweetheart and very, very giving and generous actor with all of his with all the other performers.
Well, you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned Bronco Billy, David, because I just think that was a wonderful film. I loved Clint Eastwood as that character, and I know
Yes. This
was a PG film. This was
Yes. So
very, very different. Here he was, I think a shoe salesman from New Jersey who was pretending to be this Bronco Billy and taking this Wild West show, trying to make the cowboy days live, the Old West live, taking this Wild West show around and not having the wherewithal to do it, really.
Right.
But he was trying to keep it alive. The way he would talk to the little partners, the little kids
Yes. That
came, it was just a sweet film. It's something that you don't expect, you know, from Clint Eastwood, and I really, really liked the look of it too, David, so I think you had something to do with that.
Yes, well, thank you, and I know the film is also one of Clint's favorites, simply because, you know, he was known as the guy with the big gun, as Dirty Harry, as the Western hero who shot first and maybe never even asked a question later. And for him to do this character that was more of a Gary Cooper type character that was a simple guy trying to be a cowboy that believed in the American values, that believed in children, et cetera, it was a big step for him as an actor, and something that garnered him a lot of critical attention. That was the first time, that particular film was the first time he had gotten the kind of critical attention that a lot of major filmmakers get. And, you know, because he was just kind of thought to be a right-wing guy who just shot a big gun. And now people could see a lot more to him, and they were saying, well, this is a filmmaker we should really pay attention to.
Yes.
I have to turn off my cell phone, excuse me.
They're everywhere.
Yes. So that was not, it's not only one of my favorites, I know it's also one of his favorites, because it was the first film that I like to look at it as the film that started the snowball rolling downhill for him to get his Academy Award with Unforgiven.
I think you're right. I think that was the beginning of the sort of the turning point in his career. And I'm sure it's available on DVD. People can get it from Netflix,
yes,
because many of our listeners probably haven't even heard of Bronco Billy. So I would encourage everyone to take a look at that film. Pardon me. The other one that you did with Clint Eastwood, Any Which Way You Can, you also worked then with the wonderful Ruth Gordon.
Yes, what a joy. Yes, that was an amazing film also, because it was the sequel to Every Which Way But Loose, and it was a sequel that was actually bigger and better produced than its original, and with great people in it like Harry Gardino and Ruth Gordon, and was really a thrill, because, you know, I'd been a fan of Ruth Gordon's for years and years, and to see her doing her little Ma Beto act on every day on screen was in front of the camera was just thrilling.
And her relationship with Clyde the orangutan was something.
Yes, and well, Clyde was everyone's favorite, and he was maybe you know, you think of an animal on the set as being the wild card, and Clyde was maybe one of the most professional people there. They would bring in, whenever he was called for, they'd bring his little stool in and sit him down on it, and he would do all of his tricks and hit his mark. And, you know, and then he would just try to grab beer out of people's hands and give people kisses. And he was an absolute joy to work with.
Oh, that's amazing. I was wondering if it's true. I've read that Clint Eastwood, as a director, works very fast. Is that correct?
Very fast. 75% of the time on Bronco Billy, this was my first time working with Clint, and Clint had seen some of my work before he wanted me to do this film, and this is why I always tell young filmmakers, never look down on any work. Do everything as though it were your best Academy Award-winning work, because Clint saw three films that I did. One was a little $150,000 film called Death Game. Another was a little $150,000 film called A Great Ride. And one was another little $150,000 film called Hollywood Night. So he saw three films of mine that together didn't total $500,000. And that was what impressed him to give me a shot at being his director of photography. And yes, he works very fast. As 75% of the time on Bronco Billy, he would print either the rehearsal or the first take.
Wow.
And
that
this gets well, what it does is it gets a mood going with the cast and the crew to always be on their toes and to never, because they know he wants to work quickly. And so everyone is really on their A game. An example, we were doing a scene where Bronco Billy and his team were leaving the insane asylum, and they were doing a little walk and talk on the way to the car down the stairs and out the down the front yard, and then to go to their vehicles and leave. And we did a rehearsal, and at the end of the rehearsal, Clint was still talking when we reached the end of the dolly tracks. And Clint said, more or less offhandedly, we're going to need another set of tracks. And he turned around, and I followed him, and we walked back the length of the shot and up the stairs. And by the time I turned around at the top of the stairs, the length of track was down and laid and leveled and ready to go.
Amazing.
That's amazing. Because that's the kind of professionalism that he fosters.
And he sure carried that on throughout all of his films. And I wanted to move now to your book. I have to tell you that I love the way you let your imagination run wild while working on it. That first scene where you have Orson Welles and Greg Toland meeting in the RKO commissary,
it is
just like it's a scene in a movie. And then that hooked me in, and I was just lost in that book. It's just so different. I have never read a book like this before, and I'm really psyched up about it, as you can tell. But what motivated you to write the Citizen Kane Crash Course on Cinematography?
Well, several things. First, a dear friend of mine who's a professor, full-time professor at Chapman University, where I'm currently teaching, Gil Bettman brought me into Chapman to help out. Someone had dropped out of a semester, and they wanted me to come in and fill in for this professor, and I did. And Gil has been trying to get me into the halls of academia for several years, and thank goodness he's now succeeded. Gil had already written a book about first-time directors with his publisher, Michael Wiese Productions. And he introduced me to the publisher, and I'd been working on something that was I was calling Lessons in Film at the time.
Boring.
That's right. And it was more or less a memoir of all of the lessons that I'd learned on all the locations that I'd been to all over the world. And the publisher said, we don't. It's too much of a memoir. We don't want to do memoirs. And so, you know, I was a little saddened by that, but they said, well, why don't you do a book on cinematography? you know, and you've got a little bit of cachet there, having done the two Clint Eastwood movies. And I was a little reluctant to start that because I had been directing for so many years, and now they wanted me to go back into cinematography. And I said, okay, let me think about it. Why don't you tell me the top five books that are out there on cinematography? And they told me the books, and I got them and went through them. And basically, they put me to sleep. If I ever needed to go to sleep, all I need to do is dig one of those books out, and they put you right out. They're
well,
very
the one
technical.
You wrote isn't going to put anybody to
no.
sleep.
No. Well, that's that was what brought me to the concept of doing it. I discovered along the way doing this research that Orson Welles had said to his entourage at some point, I learned everything about the art of cinematography from the great cinematographer Greg Toland in half an hour. And I looked at that statement and I said, wow, that's fantastic. But I know it wasn't half an hour. It was probably a weekend. And knowing Mr. Welles' appetites for women and booze and little white pills, I said, it was probably a pretty wild weekend. And then my fantasy took off. And that is how that whole thing was born, by finding that statement from Orson that gave me the impetus to let my imagination go on what Mr. Welles and Mr. Toland might have done that weekend while Mr. Toland was walking him down the path of these are the basics of cinematography and filmmaking.
What a great idea. And actually, this this is more a graphic textbook, I think.
Yes,
don't
it
you?
Is.
I mean,
yes, that's what people have told me, and that's what we're the publishers and I are now trying to let people know that we are starting a new genre called a graphic textbook. Because I put a disclaimer right in the very beginning of the book, several places. I say if strong language or nudity or descriptions of sex offends you, please don't read any further. Because I'm not here to offend anyone. I'm here to inform, to educate, and mostly to entertain. So I just tried to do something that was a little risque and a little irreverent, and let the young people learn, the next generation of filmmakers learn what the basics of cinematography are along the way.
And they will definitely do that. But you know what, David? It's not just people interested in cinematography who will enjoy this book. And I do love the way you presented all of the technical aspects of cinematography. But what I loved so much was the insider tidbits about movie stars and events of that era. I just thought it was just delightful. Film fans will just love to find out where did Clark Gable propose to Carol Lombard?
Yes.
How glamorous was the first Academy Awards presentation? That kind of thing. And it's just filled with little insider information like that all movie addicts like me would just eat up and just revel in it. But of course, the cinematography is the most important thing in the book. But you did a good job of packing it with fun information too. And those Madame Gaylord lookalike girls, you want to tell our listeners what that's all about?
Well, once I realized I was going after Orson Welles and Mr. Toland, I checked back into that time frame, and I did a lot of research on Hollywood, on what was happening, on the gambling ships that were off the coast of Santa Monica, et cetera, all the different places where people went for their various trysts, the watering holes, et cetera, et cetera. And I tried to weave their story in and around the facts of what existed in old Hollywood in the 1940s.
Right.
And part of what existed were call girls that were famous celebrity lookalikes you know, from the 20s and 30s.
Gene Harlow. And
that's right.
Marlene Dietrich. Right.
That's right, and et cetera, et cetera. And I made use of that little, which was something that's not new. We saw it in Hollywood. Was it called Hollywood Confidential? The film that was out, very good.
L.A.
one.
Confidential.
L.A. Confidential.
Right.
Yeah. So, but I used that as part of the device of. How to tell the story, and they became the extras that Mr. Wells and Mr. Tolan need to learn about the various sizes of lenses and various properties of light and things like that.
And the illustrations in the book, sketches done by Muse Graderson in my
yes, Muse family. Graderson, who was one of my students a year ago this time. He was taking a summer course that I was teaching at Chapman, and I saw his storyboards, and then approached him. I said, "I've got a book that's coming out. It's a done deal. It's not pie in the sky. And if you'd like a credit as the illustrator, I could certainly use you to illustrate the book." And again, it's a step toward. It's not really totally as graphically illustrated as I would like it to be. I would love to do another pass as a real graphic textbook and treat it like they do a graphic novel, where nearly every page has a very expressionistic set of storyboards. But we had enough to tell the story and to show the behind the scenes and to show the technical aspects of what we were discussing. And yes, we hope that this graphic textbook craze will catch on. And I thought that it was a way into a subject that can be very technical and dry. And I thought it was a way into it so that the young people of today who are used to MTV and used to YouTube and used to having bizarre images thrown at them all day could latch on to this and find it enjoyable, find it a good entertaining read, and as a subtext, learn about the art of cinematography and filmmaking.
And I think mission accomplished. And then the icing on the cake was getting one of my favorite actors, Bruce Campbell, to write the foreword. How did that happen?
Well, Bruce is, you know, one of my heroes, too. And a few years ago, I was fortunate enough to director of photography on three sci-fi features that we did in Bulgaria. And Bruce acted in the first one. It was called Alien Apocalypse, and then he was the director and star of the next one, which is a film that was his pet project that he'd been trying to make for 10 years, called The Man with the Screaming Brain.
Yes.
So Bruce and I had a lot of time in Bulgaria working shoulder to shoulder and side by side, and we saw that we were good friends and also good compatriots on the set. And, you know, then we both went our ways after that was done. And when this book came about, and I said, forward, who can I get to do the forward? And Bruce came to mind, and I approached him, and he was more than happy to do it. And he did, I thought, a wonderful job.
To me, that
sets the tone. If
yeah.
people know that Bruce Campbell is doing the forward, then they know this is going to be fun.
Because
Bruce is a fun guy. And you know, the highlight for me of the three Spider-Man movies is always looking for Bruce's cameo, and when he's there, he never disappoints. He always steals the show.
He certainly does, and there's a lot of people that do the same thing. You know what, David? We have a call. I'm going to see if we can get this person on the line and see what
Terrific.
Question or comment he has. Area code 607. Thank you so much for holding. This is Movie Attic Headquarters, and we have David Wirth with us. Who's calling, please?
Hi, buddy Joe. How are you today?
I'm just fine, and this must be Jazz Shaw. Am I correct?
Oh, it is Jazz Shaw, and your guest is right on topic for me, so I was hoping I could get in one question today, and I appreciate you taking the time to take it.
Well, any time, Jazz. We always appreciate your input and your calls. So, David, this is Jazz Shaw, and Jazz has a question for you. Go ahead, Jazz.
As you know, I've made some movies myself, all really terrible, I'm sure. I wouldn't even embarrass David with them. I tried to get into that project called The Lot that Fox had. And my question is about director of photography positions, because that seems to be, at least what I'm seeing so far, more difficult than even being the director of a film. Because you look at movies and you think, well, I could do that. And you get a good camera and you get like a script and a cast and you go do things. And I realized, going back and looking at my work, like every one of the shots was a combination back and forth between two perspectives at exactly the same distance. And no matter how good the script was, no matter how good anything else was, it was visually boring within about 30 seconds. So the question I have for your guest is that something you can learn in school, or is that just an artistic sense on the set that you have to move the camera as a DP and get these different angles? Because when I was doing it, I thought it was great, and when I went back and looked at it later, oh my God, it was horrible. Is that something you can learn, or is that just something you're born with? Is it an artistic?
No, Jazz. It's totally learnable. That's why we have film schools. It's very easy to learn, and the best way to learn it is watching movies.
And I watch a lot of them, but I looked at my own work and I was like, oh my God, that was terrible.
but that's the first step. And believe me, I started out just like that as a young cinematographer and editor, and I'd shoot something and I'd take it to the editing room and I'd say, that's wrong. Don't do that again. Both people are looking the same way. You didn't change the size of the image. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. The main thing is, once you see that there's a problem, is you fix it and you learn by it and you move on. And I love movies and I love studying movies. And now, especially today, it's very easy to study films by either just going to Blockbuster or Hollywood Video, or my personal favorite, which is Netflix. And I just think that this is the day, this is the time to be studying films, because not only do you get the DVDs and you can pause it, you can go through it, you can analyze a scene shot by shot by shot, you can look at the extras, you can hear the director's commentary, you can look at behind the scenes. I've even gone back to films that I saw in the 60s and 70s, like Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt, because we never had the interview with Fritz Lang in the cinema when I saw it. It's a wonderful time to study films, and I would say that is the best way to improve your work, is by studying what other directors are doing and emulating that in your work.
If I could ask one quick follow-up. In addition to studying the work of other directors, and I've studied the work of a lot of shorts directors and things, you see a lot of ads, like if you subscribe to Filmmaker Magazine and whatnot, for private study courses that you just pay and go to these more short-term courses. Is there any fast path, or do you really need to just go back to square one and do a full tour and get a degree in filmmaking from a college? I mean, are there any technical courses that you would recommend, or will that not get you there?
No, well, in your particular case, I would take a beginning cinematography course or a beginning visual course that forces you to either take a still camera or a film camera and tell a story in visuals, because that seems to be the area that you want to improve on.
Because I'm already like in my 50s, and it's like kind of late for me, I feel, to start like a 5-year college degree program at this point.
Right, and that's, you know, and there's all kinds of ways to succeed in the film business. And there are people who have gone to film school and gone through it and graduated and made great movies, like Francis Ford Coppola or George Lucas. And there are people who have just learned it as they go, you know, like Robert Rodriguez, Neil DeBute, people like this. So there's no hard and fast rule. Whatever works for you. I would say at your particular age, force yourself, take a still camera. Here's the cheapest way to do it. Take a digital camera and go out and tell a little story with two or three people just visually with that camera. And then look at the stills and say, oh, I should have gone closer here. Oh, I should have gone wider there. And start doing that. And when you feel comfortable, in fact, I encourage all my students to do storyboards of whatever film, whatever little project they're doing, with a digital camera, because it right away shows you the visual image and size that you want, and is it boring or does it need to be fixed?
Well, I will try that, and I thank you for the input, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, and I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jazz.
Well, thank you, Jazz, for calling. And one other suggestion that I would make, as soon as the Citizen Kane Crash Course in Cinematography is available, I suggest that you order a copy. Do you think that that's a good suggestion, David?
I will be doing that. You can rest assured, Betty Jo. I take all your suggestions seriously, and I will be ordering that.
Great. Well, thanks so much for calling, Jazz. I'm wondering now, David, if it wouldn't be a good time to check with Nikki and see how the chat's going. Nikki, are there any comments or questions from the chat that you'd like to share with us?
Well, first of all, I just want to say what a great show. Thank you very much. And there's not too many questions. I actually have one, though, if you don't mind, which is rare, I know.
Oh, we never mind when you have a question or a comment, Nikki. Go ahead.
Well, I love this. So I have a nephew, all right, and I'm going to order him the book. He just started his ninth grade, so he's his first year in high school, and he is amazing at claymation and animation. Even
wonderful.
As far as different angles and lighting, and he makes storyboards. He's never done anything ever professionally, but I'm just going to get him the book. And I have a lot to, you know, I think that there's a lot to say about having a natural talent and, you know, also learning from somebody like you and just, you know, being able to, like, I know he'll love the whole take. I mean, he's young, and so having that MTV YouTube kind of graphic interface is what he loves.
Wonderful.
And those are the types of movies that he'll shoot, you know, where, I mean, I say shoot, but he draws them, and then he has different, I don't even know, he uses crazy computer stuff I've never even seen. But have you done anything with that as far as the computer goes? Like a director, like what you do you have to rely on the computer and, you know, different types of, like, 'cause you can crop a picture if you don't get close enough, you know, you can bring it closer.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, Wes, no. Well, and, you know, that's the thing right now is everything is moving toward digital filmmaking. I grew up shooting 8 millimeter and 16 millimeter, and I've shot 35 millimeter all of my 30 years of my professional life. But the last two films that I directed and photographed were both high-def movies, and I had one of the best experiences in my life working with this new medium. High definition, and it is definitely here and here to stay. Has nothing to do with saying that it's better than film. It's not a matter of those kind of comparisons, but it's just like I used to have an electric typewriter. I loved my electric typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it now? It's in storage because I have
right.
Microsoft Word. I'm not saying that one is better than the other. It's just that progress has happened. And when it comes to filmmaking, progress is happening right now as we speak. And high def and things like the Red camera are taking over as the means of capture and the means of release of the films. And it doesn't change anything in the process of filmmaking. The process remains absolutely the same. It just changes the tools that we capture and that we deliver with. But yes, I've worked. I'm working a lot with the computer, as we all are. I mean, we're slaves to it. There's no way to get away from it. What I'm totally fascinated by, having done the book, The Citizen Kane Crash Course in Cinematography, all of my research I was able to do on the computer, and that is the thing I just find so fascinating. That anything that you can Google, anything that you can think of, anything you want to study, if you want to study great directors, if you want to study cameras, if you want to study still photography, whatever it is, you can get into it and you can find reams and reams of books and sites to visit and things to get into. Somebody sent me something on the Red camera the other night, and I was up till 2 in the morning looking at various sites. There was interviews with Stanley Kubrick. There was the Red camera discussed by Steven Soderbergh and Peter Jackson and examples and tests and the new Scarlett camera that's coming out and the new Epic camera. I went, wow, you know, it's just, it's amazing what is there.
It's like magic. I still think it's magic. I have no idea how it all works, but it's magical.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And you cannot stump it. You cannot come up with something that it doesn't have a reference or a list of books on, which is wonderful for people in academia or anyone who's interested in a subject. I mean, people like the great novelist, what was his name, the African-American novelist, whose last name is Baldwin. What's his first name?
We know it's not Stephen or Alan.
No, I know it's not those bald ones, but it was a great and I remember reading interviews with him, and he said, I spent all my time in the library reading books. That was his computer of those days because he grew up in the 40s. Now we have this, and people can virtually teach themselves whatever they want to learn with access to the internet.
Good luck to
your young man, and he sounds like a very talented. I mean, I went to one of the sites. Martin Scorsese was discussing Stanley Kubrick, and they were showing some early pictures of Martin Scorsese's early storyboards of biblical epics that he was wanting to do when he was a young man. So just the fact that your young man is already doing storyboards is putting him in good company.
That's great. And also, I have one other thing to say as being a producer for Blog Talk Radio. You have the most amazing voice. I have so enjoyed listening to you, and I saw that you've done, like, you were an announcer before, and your voice is so nice. Thank you.
Well, I thank you very much, and I'm available.
Okay, good.
I started, we all get bit when we're young. When I was young, I did theater, and I actually did radio. I was a radio actor in Chicago,
so nice.
And did theater and did little films and all of those things as I was getting my feet wet, and then I saw that I wanted to be behind the camera. But thank you. I appreciate your compliment.
Thank you so much, Nikki,
mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. David has a radio voice par excellence. But getting back to his book, I was wondering what was the thing that you enjoyed most about writing it, and maybe what was the most challenging thing about it, David?
Well, the thing I enjoyed most was this fantasy that I have created about the two Hollywood icons, Orson Welles and Greg Toland. These men are like Grecian gods in the film industry, and I have taken them and tweaked their image a little bit and kind of brought them down to earth and had them indulging in some rather risque activities. So that was a lot of fun to play with the icons but I don't think that any of what I imagine them doing is anything apart from what anyone in a position of privilege, whether it be a rock star or a politician, hasn't done.
Oh, yes, and I think the quotes that you included from Orson Welles in the appendix were just so revealing. That one thing that he says, I've worked my way from the top to the bottom.
That's right. Instead of starting at the bottom and working my way up, he started at the top and worked his way down. He was an absolutely brilliant man.
And then he said, "This is the best, the greatest electric train set that any boy could have about filmmaking."
Oh yes. No, he recognized that. He certainly took it to places that it hadn't been before. That was the thing. The man was, some kind of a genius. And coming out of theater and coming out of radio and then coming into film at 25 years old and doing a film which many still think is one of the best films ever made, to start with that kind of a track record and take the medium of film and stretch it as much as he did, the language of film, I just find totally amazing.
I do too, and those camera angles in Citizen Kane, they're just perfect for that movie. But I think they're the type of thing that hadn't been tried too much up to that time.
No, that's right. He and Mr. Toland invented a lot of things. There were a lot of things in that movie, going back and watching it again. I recently taught a course that I came up with at UCLA called Milestones in Cinema, that traces all of the important events that have happened in the cinema, either directing or cinematography or editing wise, from Intolerance through Battleship Potemkin, through Napoleon, down through Orson Welles, the French New Wave, the Italian Neorealists, et cetera, all the way down through the Blair Witch Project and Collateral, which of course is the inauguration of High Def. And in looking at Citizen Kane again, I found techniques in there that whole disillusion of the marriage scene that takes place in 2 minutes that's tied together with swish pans. Nobody used a swish pan again until Man from U.N.C.L.E. on TV in the 1960s.
Right.
So it's just amazing that he created language that hadn't been thought of and wouldn't become popular for 20 more years.
Yes, and some of his films that people didn't really take a shine to at first, if you look at them a little bit later, I'm thinking of Touch of Evil.
Oh, yeah, great film.
Then you see later,
yeah.
I mean, and you look and you say, oh, that's a tremendous film. So there's no doubt about it. He was a genius, so you couldn't have picked a better subject and Greg Tolan, for heaven's sakes, the legendary Greg Tolan with his...
Well, they are the reason I watched Citizen Kane when I was in high school one afternoon on television, and even with all of the commercials and everything, I got it. And that was what started the snowball rolling downhill for me in pursuing a career in filmmaking. So I owe it all to a screening of Citizen Kane.
Wow. I was wondering what's the most important thing you'd like people to know about you and your work, David?
Well, what I try and tell all of the students in almost every class I do, I draw a picture of an iceberg. And I draw the 10% above the water, and then I draw the water, and I draw the 90% below the water, and I say, what's that? And they say, oh, it's an iceberg. And I say, no. That's film production. And the 10% that's above the water is shooting the film, all being on location with all the actors and all the crew, and going to the premiere and having talk television and all the bright lights on you. That's the 10% that's above the water. That's what everyone focuses on. That's what you see on TV. That's what people want to find out more about. What's happening on the set? What's happening at the premiere? The 90% that's below the water is how and the film is made. And if the film is going to be a good film, it's all determined by the 90% that's below the water. What happens in pre-production? What kind of a script is it? What kind of a producer is it? What kind of a director is it? What kind of a cast do we have? What are the locations? What do we do in post-production? What about the editing? What about the sound effects? What about the music, the final mix? On and on and on. And think of the man hours involved in something that's as vast as a Lord of the Rings for all that 90% below the water. And that's what I want people to know, is that filmmaking is not the 10% that you see on talk television or on all of the gossip shows.
It's the 90%.
Making the films is the 90% that's below the water. It's the hard day in and day out work of making the film. And I always also tell everyone, to me, the hardest job in show business is sitting at the blank page typing fade in.
I know. I can't believe we only have 1 minute left. We could spend a lot more time with you, David. I hope you'll give us a chance to do
I'm
that.
I'm happy
but
to
our
anytime.
Time,
I'm,
our time is up, and you have made the show just fly by. You've been a super guest, and I know that your book is going to be a tremendous success, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Anytime.
Thanks so much, David. This is
Thank
Betty
you,
Jo
pleasure.
Tucker giving a big shout-out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for all their help in connection with this show. And special thanks to Nikki Starr for everything she does to make Movie Addict Headquarters happen. And, of course, to David Wirth for telling us about the Citizen Kane Crash Course in Cinematography. Please order a copy of that book. Thanks to everyone who listened in live or to the archives or took part in the chat, and to Jazz for calling in. He always calls in with such great questions. We really appreciate your participation. Remember, dear listeners, don't let your life become like a horror movie by falling victim to identity theft, the fastest growing crime in America. go to lifelock.com, LIFELOCK, lifelock.com, and learn about the important services offered there, and you'll get a 10% discount if you use our special code REALTALK, REELTALK. That's REALTALK, and it's all one word. Please come back next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for another lively discussion about movies. And don't forget to check out our movie reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. Now, here's A.J. Daniels to close the show with a song Nikki and I dedicate to all our Blog Talk Radio listeners.
And be